Listen up, football fans. You won't want to miss this.
Right now, new Bet365 customers bet $5 and get $200 in bonus bets, win or lose. So you could turn that $200 into something bigger when you bet on Moneyline, spread, totals, player props.
$200 in bonus bets when new customers bet $5. I know where I'm going to bet from now on. Download the app today and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply. In-app only.
Whatever happens today, plan to conquer it with a fresh cup of True Brew Coffee. True North Convenience Store's True Brew Coffee is a hot, flavorful gourmet blend created from coffee beans from around the world. Our brew is truly perfect for any time of the day. During October and November, enter for a chance to win free coffee for a year. Check the True Rewards app for details or find the mobile app in your favorite app store. Offer valid 10/7 through 12/1. True Convenience Stores. Fast, friendly, clean.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. What if comparing car insurance rates was as easy as putting on your favorite podcast? With Progressive, it is. Just visit the Progressive website to quote with all the coverages you want. You'll see Progressive's direct rate, then their tool will provide options from other companies so you can compare. All you need to do is choose the rate and coverage you like. Quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations. Prices vary based on how you buy.
This is Christy Strasser, managing editor of News for Odyssey. And as people in this feed may know, creator of the Who Killed Strawberry podcast. When I got an email saying that Eli Frankel, an Emmy-nominated documentarian and producer, had solved the case of the Black Dahlia and written about it in a new book called Sisters in Death, I had to know more. So here's my conversation with Eli.
I am fascinated by the Black Dahlia case. I mean, I think it's a case that has been, you know, covered so many times over the last 70 plus years.
Yeah.
For listeners, can you give me just an overview of what that case is? What happened?
Black Dahlia is obviously had tremendous interest over the years. People have called it the greatest unsolved case in American history. It's very layered. It's complex. But I think that's what's really attractive to people is that it's just got all these questions and mysteries within it. And if you start kind of diving in, you can begin to unravel some of the threads and see if you can try to figure out the mysteries of why she was over here or doing this or associating with this person. So that mystery and that complexity and the enigma of it is really central to it. I mean, essentially, the bottom line is that in terms of what the case is that on January 15th, 1947, remember, we're only like a year and a half at the outside of the end of World War II, a 26-year-old housewife is pushing her 3-year-old daughter down the street. Her name is Betty Bursinger, and her daughter is Anne. And she's pushing the stroller down the street as she walks in Lemaire Park in South Central Los Angeles. And she's walking down a 2-block weed-strewn stretch of land there. You know, the whole area is built up with homes, but these 2 blocks have not been built up yet. So it's just weeds on either side of the street and a lot of trash discarded in the weeds. And this is the famous open to every retelling of the story. Everybody always starts with it. And as she's going down, she looks to her right, and she sees the severed body of Elizabeth Short. She's been cleanly cut in two, 22-year-old girl who had arrived in Los Angeles only 5 months before, though the police wouldn't know that for another 48 hours. And there's two versions of the story. She either goes off screaming down the street to the first home and calls the police, or believes what she saw was a mannequin and then goes down the street to call the police and inform them that somebody should come to take it away because it could scare children. The police do
which
end
one seems
up
more likely to you?
Well, neither, because the book, actually, one of the big revelations in the book is that that story, which everyone universally accepts as how the body was found, is actually not true. And the person who explained to me what really happened was Betty Bursinger herself. I was able to get in contact with her about 6 months before she passed. She was 102 years old. And I had a burning question about the facts of the way that body was found. primarily that this, even though it's a remote, even though it's a two block stretch of weed strewn lot and there aren't any houses on it, it was a really heavily trafficked street. There was a streetcar that was had a stop a half block away, and it deposited hundreds of commuters onto the street. There are people up and down all the time there. And even as late as 8:30 a.m., there were witnesses who said, I walked by that exact location, and I did not see a severed, mutilated, tortured form on the grass 6 inches from the sidewalk. You know, it was left in kind of prominently open display there. And so what bothered me this whole time was, how could nobody have seen it? Like, if you see the photographs of what, you know, Bersinger apparently found that morning, and there were many reporters there later to document all that, it's so out in the open. Anybody walking by would have seen it. And so I just thought, like, how is it possible it's not found till 10:50 a.m. by Betty Bersinger? And what she revealed to me is that when she saw the body, it wasn't laying next to the sidewalk. In fact, it was about 12 to 14 feet away, hidden in the weeds. And what she did is she turned to her right, and she saw this odd, very stark white form in the weeds. And she walked in 14 feet, and she just saw the upper half, and it was face down. It was not face up. And the back was one of the only parts of her body that wasn't, like, mutilated. So to her, it just looked like half a mannequin. And she walked back out.
Even that's unusual, though. Isn't it like walking 14 feet into weeds when you're a mother walking a baby?
Yeah, well, I think she was intrigued by what it was. What could that possibly be? And so she stepped, you know, she stepped a few steps in the weeds, and she saw, you know, in front of her. But again, remember, it's kind of hidden. It's like within the weeds. She didn't go over and start touching it or picking it up or anything, but she just glanced at it for a second, thought, huh, that's really weird, and then turned around and left, and then went to the first house down the street and called police and told them, hey, there's like half a mannequin lying in the weeds, and it could scare kids, and I saw kids bicycling around in the neighborhood earlier. You should come pick it up. So in the introduction in the book, I explain what happened in the nine-minute gap between the arrival of the first officers, who went there thinking that they're just going to be picking up a mannequin, right, and putting it in the trunk and throwing it away. And then, obviously, they find what is, you know, an absolutely horrifying scene. And so the way that we understand the way the body was left, it's always been assumed that the killer was sort of a maniacal genius madman who left the body out perfectly laid out symmetrically, 14 inches apart, the two halves of the body. And it was his statement that, you know, he was so powerful, and look at the work I've done, and he's terrifying the city and sowing mass panic and fear, very much like a comic book supervillain, right? So many of the suspects that have been, you know, floated over the last 7+ decades have stemmed from that very fact that we assume, which is this guy is just going for it. He is maniacal, and he's trying to get the message out. The problem is that's not the truth. And the way her body was left is the way that, you know, nearly every serial killer has ever left their victims. They're discarded in weeds like trash.
That is one of the things that's made this persist so long in people's imaginations, is just pure gruesomeness of that.
Yeah.
Of a woman being chopped in half, you know, and somewhere else, obviously, and left there, stayed, you know, as some sort of statement, but just cutting her in half. Do you think that was done for purposes of transporting her?
No. In fact, what I think, because, you know, think about the severing of a human body cleanly through the midsection, which has almost never been seen. There are cases of people who have been cut in half in kind of vicious attacks by serial killers or other folks who just went crazy. We've seen that before. We've also seen people cut in half with power tools and chainsaws that didn't exist in 1947. But, you know, it really is utterly unique, is the care and skill and meticulousness and the time it takes to cut a person in half. I don't think it was done for expediency or efficiency of travel or anything like that. And he very easily, I mean, listen, she weighed 125 pounds. It wouldn't have been that difficult for him to just pull her out of the trunk and drag her into the lot, which is essentially what he did. I think the severing is actually central to his psychopathy. I think that it's part of, yeah, of what he does, which is, I think he was a lust murderer. I think he was a pecorist, which is somebody who gets, you know, intense satisfaction from cutting other people, cutting skin. And I think he also wanted to exsanguinate the body, meaning drain it completely of blood. And I think he was very interested in her anatomy and literally taking her apart. And yeah, and the act itself is central not to the modus operandi, it's central to the signature. It tells us his mindset and who he is. And if you really examine the photos carefully, and it's difficult to do it, you know, it's really gruesome. The cutting itself is actually not surgical. They're scalloped cuts along the edges of the skin and the muscle and the tissue. And it's not a procedure that any doctor ever did back then, nor has any doctor done today. There is no procedure that any doctor would be familiar with that would require them to literally sever through the midsection. Your patient would die instantly. It's really never been seen before in the annals of crime and murder. But that signature is so important to understanding who he is.
And well, so here's the twist, obviously, with you. You spent 5 years doing this. There have been so many people who invested into this case and so many suspects. And no one has ever been, obviously, it's ever been pinned on anybody. But you say for the first time that the person who killed the Black Dahlia also killed someone who I'm not familiar with, the Prairie Heiress case St. Louis. How did you connect those two things? And who is the Prairie Heiress and how was she killed?
Yeah, so what's interesting about this is that, and again, unlike all these other theories that have been floated, this is not my original theory. It's actually LAPD's. And in 1947, when they finally were able to figure out the mystery of this three-day period in Elizabeth Short's time in Los Angeles, you know, they wanted to figure out essentially a timeline of everywhere she had been, whom she was with, and then where she was, every date leading up to her murder. Pin down all those answers.
Bet365 is paying out before the final whistle.
Check out Bet365's unrivaled early payout offer. When you bet on a team to win and they take a 17-point lead, you get paid no matter the final score. Forget the final whistle and start counting that cash. Hold up. You get early payout on parlays, too.
Download the app and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply.
Whatever happens today, take it on with a fresh cup of True Brew Coffee. Now only $1 with True Rewards. True North Store's True Brew Coffee is a hot, flavorful gourmet blend created from coffee beans from around the world. As a free True Rewards member, pick the size that is perfect for you and pay only $1. Don't have the True Rewards mobile app? Find it in the Apple or Google Play Store to download and save instantly. True North Convenience Stores. Fast, friendly, clean.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average. And auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
Except for a three-day period right before she mysteriously escapes to San Diego, a city she had never been to and she didn't know anybody in. And this is, again, 1 month before her murder. And then she's there from December 9th to January 9th, 1947. And then she famously returns to Los Angeles on January 9th, disappears that night, and then 6 days later her body appears on Norton Avenue when Betty Bersinger walks by. So in that three-day period, they were, you know, it's a total black hole. She wasn't in contact with anybody. She didn't send letters to her family, which was very unusual for her. They, you know, they interrogate him. Right away, they detect a bunch of lies. Like, nothing he's saying matches up with the truth, and they realize he's covering for something. He's got, there's something that he doesn't want to tell us. And then subsequently, and then I explained in the book, there were pretty much every other part of his story was a lie as well. It's just that LAPD wasn't aware of it. But when they investigated him, they started looking into his past, and they realized that they found out that there was a woman that he had gone to college with in Kansas City, where he'd grown up, who 3 years later, in 1941, she was murdered in her bedroom around 3 a.m. by a mysterious stranger who exsanguinated her, tried to sever her in half, and committed other mutilations on her and left marks on her that the police immediately identified as being strikingly similar to the murder of Elizabeth Short. But Ellie was never able, and her name was Lila Welsh, and but the LAPD was never able to determine, A, if he knew her, and B, what the details were, what the circumstances were of that murder. And they tried to get all the files from Kansas City Police Department, but KCPD would, you know, kept saying, yeah, we'll send it on, but they never did, over and over again. Actually, over a course of like 3 or 4 years, they just never sent the documents on. So I felt like, well, nobody's really looked into this. Shouldn't we look into that other murder? And see? It was like the LAPD, you know, they tried and they couldn't. And I was like, okay, let's use modern technology. And I've got a lot more time than maybe the LAPD had at that time. So I want to find out what they tried to find out but couldn't. Yeah. And so I was able to, you know, do a really big, deep research project into Lila Welsh and her life, and then the details of her murder. And the book goes into all of the myriad overwhelming similarities between the murder of Lila Welsh and Elizabeth Short.
And you came to the conclusion, based on 5 years of research on both of these cases, that a man named Herman Carl Balsinger killed them.
Balsinger. Yeah.
But then, you know, what we all know about serial killers, do you think these are the only two women he killed? And what happened after Elizabeth Short's death? Because, I mean, serial killers don't tend to just stop killing, especially after something that horrific.
Absolutely. So, I mean, it's a layered story. Now, you know, I think the definition of serial killer is somebody who kills randomly at least three victims. And, you know, what we see here is two. It's very possible that this is somebody who murdered two people for his own twisted personal reasons. And that was it. However, the book also details what I consider to be the mysterious drowning of his 7-year-old sister, who was also named Elizabeth, when he was 12 years old. And the explanation by the police and the lake community where the drowning occurred makes absolutely no sense. So I speculate that may have been an early murder, a kind of a fledgling killer in his youth. His first wife died under somewhat mysterious circumstances in a horrific car accident. She was driving his car. And then there's myriad other instances throughout his life that seem to reflect the psyche of somebody who would be capable of this, including some really disturbing violence against women he had gone on dates with, and then also stalking incidents, which were horrific. He stalked for weeks an entire management company, including all their employees and agents, and they had to get restraining orders. I mean, he was a scary guy in a lot of ways and seemed very and then got involved with some embezzlement schemes that threatened to send him to prison. He ends up escaping to the Bahamas as he was under investigation there. And then a year later, this is in the late 60s, a year later, He is extradited by the Bahamas back to the United States. Something happened there that his family was never able to determine. He had gotten in some major trouble there, and so he was essentially kicked out. And then for the next 5 years, and I this is just so creepy, he ends up driving in his old white Rambler station wagon. He spends the next 5 years living out of his car and driving the highways of the northern Midwest, you know, Nebraska, Indiana, Illinois, Ohio, Missouri, Iowa, just back and forth, you know, all over those highways, including the highway that his first wife died on. This was a guy who just was never able to really carry a job for very long and seemed to constantly get in major trouble, was violent, was sexually assaulted women. He was, you know, like I said, he was a criminal, he was a crook, he was an embezzler. There's a lot there, and you know, that had never been come out before. It, you know, I heard a lot of research to get all those documents, and then I talked to his family extensively, family members who remembered him from the past. So it was an interesting journey.
Did he live a long time? I mean, how long was he active, I guess, after Elizabeth Shortstaff?
Yeah, so he died in 1977 at the age of 62 from a heart attack. There were rumors that persisted among the people who knew him that it was actually a suicide, and that the death certificate was changed in order to protect the family or something. But I do have the death certificate, and it states, you know, cardiac arrest or whatever, coronary, you know, that it was a heart attack. But I mean, he died penniless, living in a very, you know, small apartment in Kansas City, essentially cut off from the world. He had kind of burned all his bridges, you know, it just was a very ignominious end.
And one of the things that connects him to her is that she had his name written down, correct?
Well, that was with Elizabeth Short. That was with her address book. Yeah, I mean, that's absolutely verified, and it's in police reports. They did question him, and in fact, they continued to, and they had him in his sights until the case essentially went cold in the early 1950s. And if you look at all the DA reports and LAPD reports in subsequent years, his name is always at the top of the list of the remaining suspects. Mm-hmm. They had originally 350 names they were looking at. And, you know, the process they use is almost like just clearing names, getting rid of names until we get down to a handful that we can't clear. There's enough suspicion there. And the other names that are on the list are kind of the, you know, the rogues gallery of names that were, you know, people who had come into contact with her or people that the police suspected, and then they were able to clear eventually. But his name is always at number one. And the book goes into detail about some of the information that the LAPD discovered about him that had never been publicly revealed. And you begin to understand why they were so suspicious and why they spent so many resources and so many years going after him and even pursued him around the country when he disappeared for a year and a half in 47 and 48. They're trying to track him down. And I have some of the letters that the LAPD sent to the FBI and the U.S. Army trying to locate him. And then they flew out to St. Louis where he was living to interview him again. They were extremely suspicious of him.
Did he have an alibi?
No, I mean, he just claimed I wasn't with her on those days, but he definitely was in Los Angeles. And one of the big pieces of evidence that they never discovered was he had told them he was living at a building on the Sunset Strip on Sunset Boulevard, which is kind of, you know, real close to Hollywood. And that was his home. And he gave them a phone. And then this is really interesting. The phone number that was left for his name, you know, in Elizabeth Short's address book, the phone number that he gave her was not the phone number to his home. It was actually a phone number for a used car lot that a friend of his owned, and which is very odd. But I was able to determine that the small apartment building that he told them where he lived, there actually were never any units for rent at that house, at that building. It was a commercial building. And I identified where he really lived, which was in Benedict Canyon, a very remote stretch of Benedict Canyon where there were, you know, very few houses.
Would there be, I mean, I know obviously this is a hell of a long shot, but any chance that they could connect, you know, underneath the floorboards, DNA that matched her blood or anything like that?
So, you know, I don't know. The house has been remodeled. What was originally the garage where I believe that she would have been held, because I was able to get a bunch of reports from the Los Angeles LADBS, the Department of Building and Safety, for the building, you know, from way back when. They have all the documents and stuff. And there was a drain in that basement. It was a concrete floor with a drain, which is obviously ideal if you're going to do what he. So that was the garage. And then eventually, I think in the 70s and then again in the 90s, it was remodeled and turned into a bedroom. However, you know, it's very possible that the foundation and the pipes could have been original. I've walked by the house a few times. I think if I asked the homeowner, if I could tear up their floorboards, they probably wouldn't be too thrilled. But, you know, who knows what will happen one day, or somebody's curious, or if LAPD gets involved. I don't know.
Is LAPD involved at all? I mean, is this just considered a shut case? No one's looking at it anymore? Or is there someone who could still open this?
When a case goes cold, especially one that has gotten so much attention and continues to get information in by people calling in, like, my grandfather did it or whatever, they always need to have one detective who's familiar with the case and can field the call. And then if there's enough evidence that warrants some investigation, they'll, they'll spend a little bit of resources going after it. And so there is a person, you know, at LAPD who has the case, and would be responsible for taking up any information. The police department claims that they read every book that comes out, and if something warrants a serious investigation, they'll jump in. It would be awesome if, you know, they were able to read the book and they thought there's something here. But, you know, there's so much going on in with, you know, crime in Los Angeles. They've got their hands full. So I don't think they're necessarily motivated to, but it's interesting nonetheless.
Now, do you think there is any such thing in this case as justice? You think about, I mean, are there any relatives left of either one of these women who would change their lives at all for there to be a suspect or somebody named as a criminal? Or is it just for the edification of the true crime enthusiasts who, you know, want to feel like this finally got solved?
Well, no, I absolutely believe that there is a form of justice even 80 years later to be had, and it is not only an admirable goal of all this, it is a central goal. In the last couple of weeks, the Short family has read the book and has just been overwhelmingly supportive and positive about it, and feels like this is, you know, the first time she's really been captured and portrayed accurately. And you know, they believe that the theory is correct, and this is it. You know, I think at the very least, if the book can help clear up all of the mistruths and distortions that have been told about her and continue to this day, if you listen to any podcast or read any article, there's usually things in there that are absolutely not true. You know, I don't think there's any other murder victim in history who has been as maligned, falsely maligned, as she has. So, I just wanted to look at her as a 22-year-old woman who, you know, say what you will about her, bravely travels across the country to find her own happiness without, you know, barely any money. Mm-hmm. And ultimately, she was not an actress. She never sought fame. She never sought she didn't want roles. She, ultimately, what you find out when you read her letters and you read the testimony of people who knew her best, what she was looking for is what all of us are looking for, which is love. She wanted to find a partner who loved her and respected her and wanted to be happy.
She doesn't even have her name anymore, in large part. I mean, if you say Elizabeth Short, people don't really know what you're talking about. But you say the Black Dahlia, and it instantly brings to mind that the beautiful black hair, that terrible scene in the woods with, you know, the white form. Think about this poor woman, Elizabeth, a regular 23-year-old woman, forever known as a torso in the field.
Exactly right.
Horrific.
And that's the thing, it's an interesting name because a black dahlia is an impossibility of nature. It can't exist. There is no dahlia flower that is black. Dahlia comes in every color. It's a big, beautiful, showy, colorful flower. There's no such thing as a black dahlia. And so we're trying to turn her into something that never existed.
So the book is Sisters in Death, The Black Dahlia, The Prairie Heiress, and Their Hunter.
Right.
When people buy it, and they should, what's the thing that you want them to take away from this book?
See, the one thing is there's so much information about the perpetrator, the evidence, the circumstances, the investigation, the things that LAPD knew that they never revealed to the public, all the things that the LAPD didn't know that eventually now we're able to discover. But ultimately, there's one thing that I want readers to take away, is to have a better understanding of who Elizabeth Short was, who she really was. And again, to respect that and honor that and put that forward, not as a victim. Don't start with her as a victim, but think of her as a real person.
Listen up, football fans. You won't want to miss this.
Right now, new Bet365 customers bet $5 and get $200 in bonus bets, win or lose. So you could turn that $200 into something bigger when you bet on Moneyline, Spread, Totals, Player Props.
$200 in bonus bets when new customers bet $5. I know where I'm going to bet from now on. Download the app today and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply. In app only.
Whatever happens today, take it on with a fresh cup of True Brew Coffee. Now only $1 with True Rewards. True North Store's True Brew Coffee is a hot, flavorful gourmet blend created from coffee beans from around the world. As a free True Rewards member, pick the size that is perfect for you and pay only $1. Don't have the True Rewards mobile app? Find it in the Apple or Google Play Store to download and save instantly. True North Convenience Stores. Fast, friendly, clean.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. What if comparing car insurance rates was as easy as putting on your favorite podcast? With Progressive, it is. Just visit the Progressive website to quote with all the coverages you want. You'll see Progressive's direct rate, then their tool will provide options from other companies so you can compare. All you need to do is choose the rate and coverage you like. Quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations. Prices vary based on how you buy.
Hi, I'm Dr. Mary Claire Haver, a board-certified OBGYN and menopause specialist. My new podcast, Unpaused, is the place for bold, unfiltered conversations about what it really takes for women to thrive in the second half of life. Every week, I sit down with medical experts, cultural icons, and powerhouse women to talk about what really matters: your health, your power, and your future. We're covering hormones, identity, finances, relationships, and so much more. New episodes drop every Tuesday. Listen to and follow Unpaused with me, Dr. Mary Claire Haver, available now wherever you get your podcasts.